SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. We're into hour three, and the conversation with Pat went, I thought we'd go half hour, 40 minutes, give or take, but spent the full hour, and I wanted to make sure everybody understood what the whole Racing Ideas concept is and the way in which they hope to positively impact the landscape. And certainly Dick Powell, who joins us, and we're going to talk what's going on at Presque, but Dick has been involved in almost every conceivable conclave that the industry has, and has certainly seen his share of projects that were implemented successfully, and those that may have been good ideas that just didn't get off the ground and didn't get the reception they probably deserved. And so I thought the timing was interesting, just because Dick is coming on right behind Pat, and they've sat on panels together. Dick, good morning.
Steve, you caught me on a bad day. I got no sleep last night.
So you're a little punchy. You're a little. You don't have your usual acuity to rely on.
Because of my J-E-T-S, Jets. when do we win by 30 points? Come on.
Well, especially off the start of that game, which didn't look too promising right off the break.
I'm not on Twitter or any of that stuff, but I can't imagine how many Jets fans tweeted out same old story.
Exactly.
Six on the first play of the game. Well, but that was a lot of fun last night. And I listened to you and Pat. I like your skinny jeans wearing millennial comment. I wrote that one down. I enjoyed that.
Well, not that there, I don't want to come off as being dismissive, but I've been in the marketing, my background, Procter & Gamble and Danone Yogurt, and then my own business, has been in marketing and sales virtually my entire life. And it's nice. New business absolutely is important, and you got to get new business. You don't go get new business at the expense of ignoring your core business. And I don't think there's any benefit to to be running in one direction while you've got people who put a lot of money through the windows, and whether their perception, Dick, is accurate or not, there's a certain percentage, and let's be honest, I mean, the horse playing community is going to be more negative than positive, just because the nature of the paramutual system. There's going to be more people losing than winning, but at least for those that are losing, or when they're losing, if they feel like they're being attended to and being treated properly, it gives them at least a reason to to keep trying. If you were abusing your core customer, you're going to just drive them away. I mean, they already may be disaffected and disgruntled by the nature of losing. And I mean, you can make it at least somewhat palatable by, letting them feel like people care about them.
I could not agree more. And when the original NTRA started, the marketing campaign, which might have been okay in the sense that you're trying to break through the noise and get stuff on general mainstream media outlets to advertise on, but it not only ignored, but it insulted the existing core fan base. And I was really against what they did. I think it failed. And I kept explaining to people in the business, when I was in my early 20s, I used to go to Aqueduct every day. And I would either take a train, a bus, a train, or a bus from Staten Island out to Aqueduct. But I would be by far the youngest person on there. When racing was at its peak, when Aqueduct was averaging 28,000 people a day, the average fan was minimum 50 years old. So that's the way it's always been, and that works because those fans tend to have some discretionary leisure time and some discretionary income. To go after the high-hanging fruit, not the low-hanging fruit, the high-hanging fruit, which are the skinny jeans millennials, where you have to spend more money and get less return, just doesn't make any sense to me from a marketing perspective. For a couple of years, I was the director of marketing at Capital TV, and I did a lot of different things in terms of reaching out to customers with handicapping information. And I know most customers never even looked at it, but they're in the branches and they maintain this connection to the people that, as you just described, are playing a negative sum game. And if I can give them some kind of tool, I'm not going to turn them into winners. I'm not going to take all the people that are losing and suddenly Capital TV players are going to be winners. But it enhances the relationship that you have with your customer. And that has tremendous value. It's hard to measure. But my measurables were modest increases every quarter in handle that I was director of marketing. And I thought that was pretty good in a declining industry. Stopping the tide is, okay. So I think that there's a fine line. And I think what Pat's doing is looking at things that are out there that we've kind of glossed over. And breakage is a good starting point because it's there. We kind of accept it. And then there's a point that's like, well, wait a minute. The circumstances that we accepted it under are not necessarily valid anymore, at least for maybe 75-80% of the market. So why can't we change it? Well, as Pat aptly described, there's lots of constituents, there's lots of stakeholders in breakage. So it's not as easy as it might sound. Let's just get rid of it. It's going to help. There's persons, there's New York State tax, there's all sorts of things involved. But it's a good starting point. But when I was listening to him, the thought just occurred to me, and I don't know if you're a fan of The Wire, but Omar once said to Proposition Joe, I like to keep it simple. I like to keep it simple. And why do we have to round down? Why can't we round up?
Sure.
Wouldn't that be a nice takeout reduction? Because breakage historically used to be about 0.6% of takeout. Obviously, when you get up to the pick six levels and horizontal wages, breakage is hardly anything. If you play in one play show, breakage is more important. But when you level it all out, it used to be about 0.6, and my guess is it's come down because of the abundance of money that now goes into exotic wagers. So let's say it's 0.5%. Well, if we round it up, we have a nice takeout reduction and price, better prices for the customers that are playing. And Pat made one statement, and I'm not sure if I understood him, but there's this core belief that just drives me crazy that rebate players will get affected by this because somehow rebate players want higher takeout because they get higher rebates. And yet every big rebate player I know is on the record as saying, we want lower takeout. We want liquidity in the pools, higher takeout does not help us, and we want a healthy game for us to play in. So if we just said, leave all the rules the same, everyone gets the same percentage of breakage, purses, state taxes, whatever, but instead of rounding down, we're going to round up. That wouldn't be bad.
No. Not at all. When it comes to this kind of a concept, Dick, and from the extensive experience you've had, whether it's in the, you know, the various industry organs and the get-togethers and initiatives, what has worked historically at moving moving portions of the industry successfully, and what? You know, what doesn't work from your experience?
Well, I think what works is addressing what the core business is sensitive to. What doesn't work is wasting time on, I don't even know how to describe it. I'm going to measure my words here. But we seem, I'll give you a bad example. Advertising. I look at racetrack advertising, and as someone who goes to racetracks, I look at these people and I'm like, that's not what the people look like that go to the track with me. I mean, maybe on Travis Day, Sarah, Kentucky Derby or Melbourne Cup or something. But racing, when you try to dress something up and make it something that's not, I don't think that works, because then when people show up and they see real players, that's not what they just advertised. I'm not saying you got to advertise real players, but I think we make this trying to sanitize everything about the game, and including betting. Because when you watch most American racing telecasts, with the exception of NYRA and their show, which is totally devoted to betting, but I'm talking national TV, NBC, whoever it might be, betting is a real small part of what's going on. And yet when I watch racing from Australia, and I don't just mean the track feed. Australia has major TV networks that show racing. And they talk odds, they talk price drops, they talk market movers, they talk all these things, which indicates the money's going this way, the money's going that way, things like that. And that gets people interested. So I think there you can have a perfect marriage of marketing focus on business. But instead, we have a failed business model in terms of bricks and mortars. And yet most of our advertising and marketing is still devoted to bricks and mortars.
Address, Dick, that the question I'd love you to dive into. When there are efforts like Craig Burnick and Pat and the people that have signed on to this Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, when there's ideas and viable, potentially impactful initiatives, address that. What, because you've sat on plenty of presentations and moderated panels and discussions that have generated the kinds of things that over the years, could have been, very successful. What works on that front? What will get a racetrack to move? What would get an ADW to move? What would get state regulatory agencies to move? How from your experience, do you, reach goals and get things done?
Well, it's obviously tough, and what happens is, at Albany Law School, I moderated a panel of the future on wagering on horse racing. And I was the moderator, so I let everyone else talk, which was great. And Dave Haslett from Sky and Tabcourt was on. And he talked about fixed odds wagering and how it has a lower takeout and how you have to be careful of trading $0.18 to $0.10 because that's going to affect your purse levels. But they've seen an increase in purse money. They've seen a stabilization of parimutuel betting, and they've seen this big growth in fixed odds wagering. Now, here's the difference. His country doesn't have the regulatory bureaucratic nightmare that we have on everything, whether it's horse racing, whether it's opening up a lemonade stand outside the Saratoga County Fair. I mean, this is who we are. So trying to get anything done, so you get a good idea, it makes sense, let's sell it, let's do all these things, let's give everyone an agreement. Well, eventually, there has to be some kind of recognition and understanding. Is this allowable? Chances are no. And fixed odds wagering is a good example because most laws are written for parimutuel wagering. And to just suddenly say, well, we're going to go over to fixed odds, well, that might not fit the letter of the law. Because basically the way governments work is they prohibit everything, and then you need legislation to enable things. So whatever's enabled is probably pretty specific, and then if you want to go a little bit outside that specificity, then you need more legislation or perhaps new rules and regulations, which have their own processes, timelines, public comment periods, things like that. So the problem is to take it from start to finish, and as you mentioned, NJRA with Alex Waldrop, was able to get the rules changed on IRS withholdings. And that took a long, long process, but it took the involvement of the government, in this case the federal government, to make that change, even though everyone agreed it was a good idea. So getting everyone to agree is not the easy part, but if you can achieve that, you then have to work within this environment that makes some of these new, different ideas very tough to implement. Now, I think Nevada has a big advantage because they don't have what we have, most states, so they can do things, you know, in-game betting and sports and things like that that they've been able to do and kind of be the forerunner for that in the United States. And now some of the states that are legalizing sports betting are going to that. So that there's good ideas, and then there's good ideas that can be implemented. And the issue really comes down to I'm trying to sell an idea to someone, and the person on the other side of the desk agrees with me, but they know how hard it's going to be to get this through and how big a, what they call in the lobbying world, how big a lift it's going to be. And if it's going to be a heavy lift, which means a lot of constituencies and fundraising and a PAC and, you know, all that stuff to get it through, well, is this where we want to focus our energies? The IRS withholding, absolutely. And we've seen the results, and the results have been just terrific. But a lot of the other things just get bogged down in just the way all our governments, now I'm not picking on any one government, all our governments are way too bureaucratic, and to just change anything becomes very, very hard. But that's not an optimistic answer. A realistic answer, it's a pragmatic answer, but that's, unfortunately, that's what we've seen. And so the answer is, you know, Dick, you go to all these conferences, what have you gotten done? Hey, you're right. But you get to the point where you go into a legislature and you go into a committee and you try to explain things, and you're not dealing with people with your knowledge level. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. I was involved in something last winter that was pretty fascinating, but it was way off the beaten path. And to try to explain what we wanted them to consider was a challenge. And I don't think we ever succeeded on that. And forget about getting it done. So there's that part. There's the part of getting it implemented. And there's the whole morass of bureaucracies that are out there that are not against you, but you have to tiptoe through them, and you know you can't fall off the rock, and otherwise you got to start all over. So that's the really difficult part. So it's frustrating for me that you hear good ideas, you hear here's what other places are doing. Wow, wouldn't that be great? We should try that. And then suddenly reality hits, and when you go to try it, well, we got this, we got that. Jack Jaworski got up and gave a from Monarch, and he talked about what was it? It was one of the latest things that's being bandied about. It was either payout, you know, like you got to pick five, and the ADW can pay you out after three legs or four legs or something like that. And whatever it was, they went to the state of California in this case, and the answer was no. So at that point, it doesn't matter how good the idea is, how many people support it, or how long you discussed it or anything. And part of that no is just a lack of understanding. I once testified before the California Horse Racing Board, and it was a very specific thing, and I could not get them to understand the exact point of my argument, that this was a bankruptcy, and my client should not have been in this bankruptcy, and I'm trying to explain settlement money and how settlement money should never be part of a bankruptcy, that it's not the track's money, it's the bettor's money that haven't been paid back by the third party, ADW, and this, good luck trying to do that in 10 minutes, which is all I had. So I don't want to burst any bubbles, but while they're working on these ideas, they have to work on strategies of implementation. Where would be the best states? Which places could we get this done first so that other states might follow? Which states do we want to avoid because their bureaucracies are so, you know, bound and determined to, you know, reject change and things like that. So, well, I think if they're doing a parallel approach, then they got a chance of, well, if we got this idea and we all agree it's a good idea, here's where we might want to try it out.
Well, and as we've seen from the Model Rules Initiative, you take that same approach, and that. Yeah, you know, we've seen that, and there were certainly areas when RMTC and when the concept was being forwarded, they were concerned about jurisdictions they expected to be, you know, to be slow to respond, and Louisiana and Florida are always the ones that are sizable racing states that. You know, they're always concerned about, you know, making any changes, and yet they both fell into place faster than expected. So and the same thing I always bring up, you know, for people that say nothing ever, you know, gets moved, I always bring up the elimination of steroids. That took less time than anybody expected, and in basically a year and change, every jurisdiction got on board. So, using that as an example, we should be confident, or at least acknowledge that, you know, uniformity is achievable because there's examples of it. So, I knew that, you know, you'd had extensive experience in trying to move things from the drafting table, you know, into practice.
Even with the steroids, yes, we banned steroids, but not every state tested for steroids. So we had a PR victory.
Well, it was more than a PR. It was way more than a PR victory, Dick. I mean,
But to have states not testing, saying they're banning it, but they're not going to test for them, are they really banning it?
Well, that's a different. I mean, that's a whole separate argument. But I mean, there's the whole program of, you know, of the, you know, the group of medications that can be used. The therapeutics, and anything that falls outside that realm is testable. So I mean is it a gray area? I suppose, but at the same time, the areas of the greatest amount of racing, the most important markets were testing, and so we have the out of competition question now that's being addressed, and that's been an outgrowth, but. I mean, to say that this was some sort of a Pyrrhic or some sort of a publicity win only is wrong. In fact, the benefits go well beyond just the racing side of it. It goes toward the breeding side as well. So I would contest that's a jaded view of it.
Oh, it is, but it was bureaucracies that didn't want to test. It was back to my original point about trying to implement good ideas.
Well, and that's the challenge that the TIF is yeah. going to be charged with or have charged themselves. It wasn't like somebody said, "Oh, go do this." They're taking it upon themselves, and that's to be applauded. Well, let's turn our attention. I've got to get to John White yet. Let's get a quick review of these waning weeks at Presque Isle, and we got a couple of very big races, and in particular, the Grade Two Masters, which will send at least one or two off to the filly and mare sprint.
Doing a little research and watching the Keeneland sale last night, and a Tappet colt, I believe, went for $1.4 million, and he was out of Miss Macy Sue. And Miss yep. Macy Sue was the original winner of the Presque Isle Masters in 2007, at least that's as far back as Equibase goes. And Miss Macy Sue has produced Liam's Map and Dale Roman's wonderful two-year-old, Not This Time, who unfortunately did not race at three. So Miss Macy Sue turned out to be a terrific brood mare, and she not only won the Presque Isle Masters, but she ran second in it the next year. We've had Informed Decision. We've had Groupie Doll win it 2 years in a row. As you mentioned, Amy's Messer and Bar Gold competed in the race last year. Race just has a terrific record of producing starters in Breeders' Cup dirt races. You can go from Tapita to dirt, and we've seen it over and over again. So Monday night's race, which past performances are available, the race hasn't been drawn yet, but not the problem, but we have free nominations, so there's a lot of horses nominated. But among the notables are Amy's Mason. Now, she's coming into this year's race a lot differently than last year. Last year, she had won the Seaway Grade 3 up in Woodbine. She won the Ontario Matron. So she was coming in on a win streak when she won the Masters and then just got beat in the Breeders' Cup Filly Mare Sprint. She's only had one start at Keeneland in April, and that was the Madison, where she was beaten a length and a half by Findlay's Lucky Charm. She seems to be training well. Josie Carroll drilled the 7 furlongs in 1:26 up at Woodbine, and the key there is she's training on Tapita. Code Warrior ships in for Michael DePaulo. I assume she's running. She went gate to wire in the Seaway, so she's coming in kind of off the same path as Amy's Mason did. And the Woodbine horses tend to be dangerous now, not that they have Tapita. There's not a surface switch for them to come down and race not that far a ship either. So the Woodbine horses will be ones that you want to keep an eye out for. Noted and Quoted is nominated by Mike Stidham. She was a Grade 1 winner as a two-year-old. Santa Anita. And lots of good fillies. Ruby Notion, who won the Caress Stakes up here in a turf sprint on soft turf. That form should carry over to Tapita. And Darren Miller is the trainer of that one. And just a lot of nice fillies. Now, what historically happens is a bunch will enter, and then there'll be some scratches. Hopefully not a lot, and hopefully no one gets scared off. So sometimes people kind of stick their foot in the water. They see how the race draws. They see where they draw, and then they may and may not come. But for $400,000, 6.5 furlongs on Tapita this time of year, it's just a great spot. And I think more and more trainers have recognized how good this race is as a prep for a future, whether it's the Breeders' Cup or anything else down the road, Akima and a Churchill, stuff like that. So that's going to happen Monday night. Usually it's around race 5. And then Sunday night is the Presque Isle Mile, $200,000 going to two-turn mile. And that is also attractive. A lot of horses on the early nominees. That'll be drawn, I think, later today. It's not out yet. But that will also have a nice field. But that's going two turns, so you have to be a little careful with post positions. The Masters are 6.5 furlongs, so they have a nice long run down the backstretch, which always helps everyone kind of unsort themselves going into that first turn. But the mile, 200,000 two-turn race, should have a good field. But based on the early nominees, there's a lot of good horses looking at the race, including horses like Ghost Hunter and the horses we've seen before. I kind of root for the local Presque Isle horses when the big money's on the line. I'd like to see them do as well as possible. And then, as I said, the Woodbine Shippers, now that they went over to Tapita, they look tough in all the races that they enter. So big, big races coming up. We got the Mrs. Henry Paxton as well on Sunday for two-year-old fillies. We get to see Amy Farrah Fowler, who disappointed when she went into the Mark McDermott Pennsylvania bred male. She ran second, but she kind of ran a little erratically in the stretch. She's entered back or nominated back for the Henry Paxton on Sunday night as well, and that'll be interesting to see if she can bounce back or whether she's vulnerable, whether that kind of erraticness in the stretch, which I know some sheep guys, they see bear out and they're ready to go against that horse next time out. We'll see if that's a factor. But she'll certainly be bet pretty strong if she does go in a race and might be worth trying to find someone else for an upset. Tonight, we have 8 races. We've had some rain there. And even though it's Tapita, it doesn't get sloppy or anything else. It does usually favor speed a little bit, although checking the charts and watching the races, that has not really been the case in the last couple of days. Excuse me. So tonight we're going to go into race number 3. 6 furlong maiden claim. We're going to go at number 1. 9-2 morning line. Treasure the Storm, a daughter of Treasure Beach. Added Blinkers 2 back. For its Tapita debut, didn't do any well, showed some speed, but got a bad start, bumped around, rushed up, weakened. The next start, dropped down to maiden claimers, held its speed right to the deep stretch. Third start off the layoff. The first start, she had an excuse, back in against maiden 25 claimers like she was last time, and does show enough natural speed that post one can actually be an advantage tonight with Eddie Dominguez in the iron. So that's race 3, number 1. Treasure the Storm. And then for our other play tonight, we will go to race number 7. Number 1, Unflinching, Teresa Connolly, Pablo Morales. They combined 37% the last 63 starters. This is a horse, of course. She's won 12 times at Presque Isle. Was a good second last time out, going 6th. I'm a little worried about the inside, but when you got the leading rider by a mile at Presque Isle, I think he can save ground with her and find a seam and get out and find clear running and run these down. So that's race 7, number 1, Unflinching. Don't forget, my picks are available each and every race day at Presque Isle Downs on PresqueIsleDowns.com. Just click on racing, and the picks will be over on the right-hand side.
Dick, I appreciate it, and we'll look forward to I guess recapping actually, and
well, it's up to you. If you want to do Monday when we have
I'm not going to be available Monday, as it turns out.
Okay.
And that's not going to work. We'll just have to invite people. They'll certainly be tuned in for Monday nights, Monday afternoon, early evenings. Grade 2 Masters. So we'll recap. Although maybe we could even, maybe even Friday, we could even we could preview it for weekend preview.
Okay. Yeah. Give me a shout.
Excellent, Dick Powell, everybody,
thanks,
and thanks a lot, Presque Isle. 18 cards remain. October 4th, they race through. So this sprint has been so productive for the Breeders' Cup. Expect the same for this year. Let's take a break. Last of the morning, and we'll get to John White. Actually, late getting to John. I apologize. John White next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Join us at Presque Isle Downs for our two biggest days of racing. Sunday, September 16th, the $200,000 Presque Isle Mile. Monday, September 17th, the Grade 2 $400,000 Presque Isle Masters. North America's top filly and mare sprinters compete in the Premier Breeders' Cup Prep Race. Free Presque Isle Masters hats for the first 1,000 fans. Free t-shirts each night for the first 500 fans. September 16th and 17th, Presque Isle Downs, Erie, Pennsylvania. For more, go to PresqueIsleDowns.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 384643.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back, and just about 10, 12 minutes, got a little longer there with everything's gone longer today than expected. except for a visit with Bo that got caught short because the power went out. John White standing by, and we missed John last week. The week kind of spiraled out of control. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve, and I want to start by offering our congratulations to our good friend and one of the best people we know in racing, Jay Pribman, for his marriage last Saturday. Tracy and I attended his wedding reception and had a great time there, and that was just really terrific. We wish all the best to Jay and his wife, Ann, going forward. And I was enthralled with your conversation here on the breakage because I'm holding in my hand a program from Playfair Racecourse on September 21st, 1975, which was when I made my first $1,000 win bet on a horse. It was in the Harvest Handicap, mile and 70 yards, 30th running, and I bet Refusal, who was a 4-5 favorite on the board, won by 6 lengths, broke the track record. For my $1,000 wager, if it was back then, Washington had nickel breakage instead of the, and they now have dime breakage. So they went in the wrong direction. After I left the Pacific Northwest in 1980, sometime after that, they went from nickel breakage to dime breakage. And people say, well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is nowadays he would have paid $360, so I would have got back $1,800. I would have had an $800 profit. In 1975, I got back $1,850, so I had a profit of $850. So that's a $50 difference in 1975. And math is not like my strongest subject, but I did a little investigating on the Internet, and from the best that I can tell, based on inflation, that would be like a $200 difference today. In other words, I would have collected an extra $200 just for doing nothing except the fact that the difference would be nickel breakage versus dime breakage. And so I was fortunate in all those years in the 1970s in the Pacific Northwest when I was betting $200, $100, what have you. That adds up. I mean, when you're talking about $50 in one day, that's money that very well would have been churned back into that wagering at some point. So it's an important subject. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and it feels like an easy win for the industry.
It does. It really does, which means right off the bat I'd almost make it a long shot the way the industry works, but sometimes the industry does recognize a problem and is proactive in it. The Breeders' Cup, I think, is an example of that, that it wasn't a problem, but, you know, the fact that the industry could get together and start the Breeders' Cup, you know, I mentioned Jay Pribman, and if you look at his outstanding Breeders' Cup coffee table book, he points out in there how that first Breeders' Cup, there was really the thought it might not succeed, that it might be the only one. It was that revolutionary in 1984. And it was. I mean, it was quite revolutionary in this sport. So the sport, you know, was able to come together for that. I think of Equibase. You know, the Daily Racing Form was responsible for the past performances for this game and had a monopoly on it for a long, long time during many of the years that I worked for the Racing Form, and during many of the years I was a chart caller for the Racing Form. And, in fact, when Equibase started, Equibase chart callers would be stationed at a different place in the press box or near the press box, calling charts simultaneously as I was. And so you had two different charts coming out. And then eventually, but the industry was afraid that if the Racing Form decided to just fold one day, people would be showing up at Belmont Park or Santa Anita or Playfair or whatever track you have, and they'd say, well, where's the Racing Form? I need some information to make a bet here. And they'd say, well, sorry, the form folded up, and so we don't have anything. And the form, the Equibase, through the Jockey Club, was able to sit there and say, you know what, we better get together here, and we better come up with our own past performances. And then the form eventually sold out to Equibase and disbanded all of its chart calling operations. So, like I say, sometimes the industry is proactive and can get together, so there's always hope. You know, the tax withholding situation, I think, is obviously a tremendous illustration of that, because I honestly, Steve, thought we'd never see that happen.
Right.
I know the NTRA worked its tail off to get it done, and I certainly salute them for that, because I thought trying to explain this to, the people in charge, the powers that be, to ever get that changed, I thought was like, you talk about a long shot. I thought that was a gigantic long shot, and it happened. I mean, and I think that's a huge plus for the industry. So there's always hope. But as I say, I mean, I just go back to that first $1,000 bet I made in my life, And a $50 difference in my pocket in 1975, I mean, that is a substantial difference.
Well, there's a lot of things that are kind of laying in wait that can be impacted here, and if they tackle them one at a time and very, you know, very consciously and have a game plan, I think there's some things that can be. That can be accomplished, and we've got plenty of examples of things that that have been changed in recent years that we can we use as examples. I think we got a lot of from this discussion with Pat today, and then Dick following up too. I mean, There's reasons to be there's always reasons to be optimistic, and I would go after the least resistant areas first and get some wins, get some momentum, and go from there. Speaking of momentum, we're rolling into the fall, John. We didn't get a chance to talk last week, so we didn't get to kind of wrap up your views of the summer season. Got about 2.5-3 minutes. Some thoughts about what you're monitoring as we begin to shift the focus toward Breeders' Cup.
Well, the one thing I did want to point out for Del Mar, because it's, at least according to my research, it's historic, and that was Baffert's 14th win in the Del Mar Futurity, because according to what I can research, that is the record for a trainer in any current Grade 1 race, the most wins by any trainer. And this is the type of thing, again, I think our sport is takes a back seat to the other sports that has, like the Elias Sports Bureau, that to where you get that type of information. And in fact, it's Baffert who has got the second most wins in any current Grade 1 race, and that's 10 in the Los Alamitos Futurity. So Baffert's first and second in that, and the 14 in the Del Mar Futurity, that's a pretty sizable lead. And then Dwayne Lucas has won any of the current Grade 1 races 9 times twice. He's won the Del Mar Debutante 9 times, and he's won the Chandelier, which was formerly the Oakley Stakes, 9 times. And the only other trainer that's won any of the current Grade 1 races 9 times or more is Charlie Whittingham, who won the Santa Anita Handicap 9 times. But, I mean, what that does, it really puts, once again, here's Bob Baffert, who's won the Triple Crown twice, but it shows you the breadth of the accomplishments of Bob Baffert in terms of dominating races. And, of course, don't forget the Haskell Invitational and how many times he's won that race, too. So, you know, what Bob Baffert has done in some of these Grade 1 races in terms of his dominance is truly astounding.
No doubt. Well, John, got a little bit more at Los Al to look forward to before we shift gears back to Santa Anita, and we'll get more into a build-up into the fall when we talk next week.
And I'm also looking forward to McKenzie, because he's kind of became the forgotten horse. And, boy, he had another outstanding workout, 7 furlongs and 124 and change. And according to Baffert, it's all systems go for that race, the Pennsylvania Derby. And, if he were to run a big race there off the bench, I mean, he would be right back, into prominence going to that Breeders' Cup Classic. So as high as Baffert was on him early in his career, to me, he's kind of an exciting prospect to contemplate in terms of this last part of the season. So really looking forward to McKenzie, and looking forward to Santa Anita with that races like that American Pharoah. Well, that'll be interesting, too. Instagram with a sharp workout yesterday for Jerry Hollendorfer.
Well, and going to be down in Philadelphia, looking forward a week from Saturday, Pennsylvania Derby and the Cotillion, which shaping up to be terrific. So, and McKenzie seems like he's zipping toward it nicely, and Saw that West Coast with a sharp work yesterday, too, gearing up for his return.
And Collected's coming along very nicely for Baffert, too. In fact, I'm kind of getting the feeling we might see Collected in that awesome again.
Nice. That'll be great. John, I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Talk next week. John White, everybody. Post Time John. Again, Happy New Year, everybody. Happy, healthy. I made a brisket that, I'll tell you, my mother might come back for that brisket. She'd have been delighted. And a kugel, too. Noodle kugel. I want to thank Pat Cummings, Brian DiDonato, Bo Lane, John White, Dick Powell. Tuesday, and there's some action around today. And tomorrow and Thursday, though, Kentucky Downs. Hope the weather is cooperating and we get a good course to use tomorrow. Talk to you tomorrow.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Join us at Presque Isle Downs for our two biggest days of racing. Sunday, September 16th, the $200,000 Presque Isle Mile. Monday, September 17th, the Grade II $400,000 Presque Isle Masters. North America's top filly and mare sprinters compete in the Premier Breeders' Cup Prep Race. Free Presque Isle Masters hats for the first 1,000 fans. Free T-shirts each night for the first 500 fans. September 16th and 17th, Presque Isle Downs, Erie, Pennsylvania. For more, go to PresqueIsleDowns.com.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you want unlimited access to handicapping without exorbitant prices? Then BrizNet.com has you covered with a variety of plans for past performances, pedigree, and raw data. The BrizNet.com Performance Plan offers unlimited PDF past performances for just $75 per month and is available at BrizNet.com/PP. American Produce Records Online puts the pedigrees of nearly 1 million dams and more than 2 million foals at your fingertips, plus sire stats, for only $275 per year, and is available at BrizNet.com/APR. The BrizNet.com data plan offers unlimited access to race day data files, perfect for handicappers with their own database or to plug into other people's programs. The data plan is just $125 per month. Visit BrizNet.com for all this information and more, and discover why BrizNet.com is the handicapper's edge.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.